This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Supreme Court handed down two landmark decisions last week. Both of them could have serious implications here in North Carolina. On a 5-4 vote, the justices declared that same-sex couples were entitled to federal benefits. Also on a 5-4 vote, justices struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act. That move frees North Carolina and a number of other states, most of them in the South, to change their election laws without prior federal approval. Joining us now to talk about these cases are three legal experts. Jeanette Doran is Executive Director and General Counsel for the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central University. And Neil Siegel is a professor of law and political science at Duke University. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you on the program.
Good to be here.
Taking your calls this hour, 877-962-9862. Call us or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. What do you think of those Supreme Court rulings? What impact is it going to have here in the state of North Carolina? 877-962-9862 if you want to join our conversation. Neil, let me start with you. Voting Rights Act, give us an overview of what happened.
Well, the case turned on Sections 5 and 4 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which the Supreme Court in the past said was passed to address entrenched racial discrimination in voting, what the court called an insidious and pervasive evil, which had been perpetrated in certain parts of our country through unremitting and ingenious defiance of the Constitution. Section 5 requires states and parts of states, mainly but not exclusively in the South, to get permission, what's called preclearance, from the federal government before changing voting rules, like limiting early voting or imposing a voter ID law. The law puts the burden on jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination to show that any voting change will not make worse off minority voters who are protected by the law. And then in Section 4, Congress provided a coverage formula for determining the covered jurisdictions to which Section 5, the preclearance requirement, applies. And it defined them as states or political subdivisions that use tests or devices as prerequisites for voting and had low voter registration or turnout in the 1960s and 70s. What the court did, 5-4, is strike down the coverage formula in Section 4 of the law, left Section 5 standing, but also left it inoperable because if there are no covered jurisdictions under Section 4, there's no work that Section 5 can do.
All right. And so in writing for the majority, Justice Roberts said essentially our country has changed, Jeanette. It was a time for this provision of the law to be rejected.
That's right. And I think Roberts made a compelling argument that the flaw with the most recent congressional effort is that it was based on 40-year-old history. And he makes a good point of explaining that history isn't stagnant, that the data the Congress had relied on was from the 60s and 70s. And since then, we've had 40 years of progress. And so I would add to Neil's remarks that the decision leaves open the door for Congress to come back and revise that formula. So I don't think it's safe to say that preclearance requirement is over and done with forever. It would be up to Congress, though, to come up with a formula that reflects current needs.
And, of course, Congress has come back to it. It's been up for revision and review periodically since 1965 when it passed. So, Irving Joyner, historically, Voting Rights Act has been an instrument in making sure that African Americans had the right to vote. Is it time? Are we a new country? Is it time for that provision to end and we now can move on?
Well, according to Chief Justice Roberts, we are, but he had absolutely no experience with the old country that we are still a part of. So while it is 40 years since the Voting Rights Act was enacted, the realities which existed then continue to exist today, and indeed right here in North Carolina. So an assertion that there is not an attempt to undermine the voting strengths of African Americans and racial minorities is far-fetched and clearly not supported by any real evidence or any real history.
Well, the evidence Justice Roberts points to is the fact that voter registration among African Americans way up, 6% in some places, now up to 60%. Some of the worst places of racial violence now have African American mayors. So that's the evidence he points to. He said things have changed.
Well, I mean, those are part of the reality, but that's not the total scope of the intent behind the Voting Rights Act. And it was to ensure that there would be there would not be continuing efforts to disenfranchise African Americans and racial minorities. And those efforts are continuing in spite of the progress that's been made in terms of increased registration. There are already current efforts to decrease.
Such as?
Right here in North Carolina, we talk about voter ID, number one. We talk about the elimination of early voting. We talk about the elimination of souls to the polls and other efforts that
it was voting on Sundays.
Voting on Sundays, yeah. Right. And other efforts that have resulted in a significant increase in the participation of minorities in the political process. So that is constantly under attack, and it's under attack in North Carolina. And indeed, Shelby County, Alabama, probably was the longstanding offender of the Voting Rights Act, and has continually been before the court because of improprieties in their election process.
Well, what about that, Jeanette? I mean, maybe all of these gains have been made precisely because this provision was in place. And so if you pull it out, if the underlying conditions haven't changed, as Irving Joyner suggests, we could be back to the same old thing. How do you feel about all of that?
Well, 2 points. One, Justice Roberts made a point of addressing that kind of deterrent justification for using the Section 4 formula. And as he explained, I think very articulately, if we rely on the deterrent effect to justify this extraordinary measure, the preclearance requirement, then the preclearance requirement would perpetually evade review. But I also want to emphasize, as the court did, that the Section 2 prohibitions on standards or practices that would deny or abridge the right to vote, that prohibition, those Section 2 prohibitions are still firmly in place. No one can doubt those. And those are applicable nationwide. So to the extent that some of the measures that Professor Joyner just referenced, to the extent that a court were to find that those did abridge the right to vote, a court would still have the available remedy of an injunction issued under and pursuant to Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Well, let me ask Neil a couple of questions with regard to that. First, how many – so the preclearance was meant to make sure that no barriers were created. So how often was it invoked, and how often did the Fed, say, turn back rules or changes in voting rules in these – states that were covered?
I can't give you the data on that. I know there are plenty of challenges that were made, including while this case was pending, and the feds approved many, many requests and also denied a good number of requests. But I don't have the data. I do think it's important to note, though, that I'd like it to be the case that no one can doubt Section 2, but in fact, opponents of the Voting Rights Act long argued that Section 2 itself was unconstitutional. And then the move seemed to be made from Section 2 to Section 5. And so we'll see whether Section 2 remains in place.
Just to clarify this, so Section 2 says, look, there are things you still can't do. They're illegal, and you can take it to court if you think you're being discriminated against.
The language of the statute is it bans any standard practice or procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen to vote on account of race or color. That applies nationwide. It's permanent. It's not at issue. But it is the case that many opponents of the Voting Rights Act have charged that Section 2 is unconstitutional. Mm. Even if it stays in place, and that's an if, it's long, it's laborious, it's difficult. And the reason why Congress thought Section 2 was not enough is because once you go through a Section 2 litigation and get a court to strike something down, then states and covered jurisdictions would come back with something else, and then you'd have to start over. Section 5 was supposed to prevent that. And what Justice Ginsburg said in her dissent is that the reason things have changed, not entirely, but significantly, is because of the Voting Rights Act. And to strike it down now because it succeeded too much is like closing your umbrella during a rainstorm because you're not getting wet.
Well, Section 5 was supposed to be preventive, to keep these obvious efforts to discriminate from occurring. Section 2 comes in after the fact, after there has been a history of discrimination, which you have to establish in court. And that is a time-consuming process, while Section 5 is an administrative remedy in many instances that can keep the enactment from occurring and the harm from accruing in the first instance. And that's why Section 5 is important.
So in short, Jeanette, it shifts the burden of proof from the state having to prove it's not discriminating under Section 4 and 5 to the defendant or the plaintiff complaining that they've been discriminated against, proving that.
Essentially, yes. But I also think, you know, we need to keep in mind that the provisions of Section 5 were never intended to be permanent. They were extraordinary and initially started out with the idea that they'd last only 5 years, and then it's been extended and extended. And I just wanted to follow up on something that Neil said a minute ago. I have no doubt that we may see future litigation about Section 2, but I do think the listeners should be aware that the decision last week itself took pains to explain that Section 2 was not at issue, and that's important.
On the state of things today, we're taking your phone calls, 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org. We'll continue our conversation with Jeanette Dorn, Executive Director and General Counsel of the North Carolina Institute of Constitutional Law. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central. Neil Siegel, a professor of law and political science at Duke. Your calls, 877-962-9862. Last week's Supreme Court rulings, we're talking about the Voting Rights Act, and we'll talk about gay rights when our program continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today talking about last week's decisions by the Supreme Court on the Defense of Marriage Act and voting rights. Jeanette Dorn's with us, Executive Director and General Counsel for the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central University. Neil Siegel is a professor of law and political science at Duke. And you at 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org. If you want to talk about these decisions and what impact you think they have on all of us here in the state of North Carolina and elsewhere. Jeanette, I want to come back to you and talk about this business of the sunset provisions in these laws or in the voting rights law. I mean, as you said, Congress has come back to them. And in her dissent, Justice Ginsburg said, and it's precisely Congress who should decide whether or not it is time to change these rules and not the court. What do you say about that?
That's entirely consistent with what the majority opinion was. The problem the majority opinion pointed out was that Congress relied on 40-year-old data. And Roberts very specifically invited Congress that Congress could come back and produce a new formula to reflect current needs. And current statutes need to be justified based on current needs. So there is nothing in any way that would prohibit Congress from revising its formula to reflect the realities of America in 2013.
What about that, Neil? Was the court within its brief to say, no, your law on this, because it's relying on old data, you haven't kept up and therefore this provision is gone, come back and fix it? Or is it up to Congress to decide we are using old data, we should fix it?
Well, first, I want to disagree with the premise that Congress was just using old data. It was using the old coverage formula from the 60s and the 70s. But it held many, many hearings, and you had both houses of Congress by large majorities reauthorizing it based on a lot of current data and a lot of current studies. So it wasn't just old data. Justice Ginsburg in her dissent engages the record in a way that the majority opinion doesn't really care to. It talks about an FBI investigation in 2010 in which you had state senators in Alabama, right, the very same state in which Shelby County is located, referring to African Americans as Aborigines and talking openly of their aim to quash a particular gambling-related referendum, because if the referendum were placed on the ballot, then African Americans might come out to vote. Every black, every illiterate, they said, would be bused to the polls on HUD finance buses. So this is a lot of current data. But as to the question, you know, we had a civil war. And then in the wake of the Civil War, there were transformative constitutional amendments that were added to the Constitution. And you wouldn't know that reading the majority opinion. You would know about the 10th Amendment. You would know about what the majority calls a fundamental principle of equal state sovereignty that most professors of constitutional law have never heard of. You wouldn't know that it was the slaveholding Supreme Court that brought us Dred Scott, and it was Congress explicitly in Section 2 of the 15th Amendment that was empowered to enforce Section 1's prohibition on racial discrimination in voting by appropriate legislation. Appropriate legislation refers to a very deferential standard of review. McCulloch against Maryland, a seminal decision of the Marshall Court, rational basis. The dissent hangs its hat on rational basis. I think the majority opinion is the very antithesis of rational basis. If the court were prepared to defer to Congress, who by the terms of the Constitution is given primary authority to interpret and enforce Section 1 of the 15th Amendment, you would have had a very different outcome. I think the majority must know that it's very unlikely that Congress and members of Congress are going to indict their own jurisdictions and come up with a different coverage formula. And I also think if Congress does, it's unlikely that the Roberts Court is likely to uphold it.
Well, but let me ask you about that, Irving Joyner. I mean, isn't the appeal now to Congress? Congress does have the authority to do this by the court decision and by all accounts. So let's go to Congress and get this thing changed.
Well, I agree with the points that's just been made. I don't expect this Congress, which is totally dysfunctional, to do anything in the voting rights area. They can barely do anything in any other area. So you have to have the House and the Senate to agree, and assuming that you can get the Senate to do something, you're not going to get the House to do anything at this point. But what this does, though, is pull the plug out. The old Voting Rights Act allowed every jurisdiction to bail out of coverage, and all it had to do was to show that for 10 years, just 10 years, one decade, for 10 years that it ran a clean ship and that there was no racial discrimination. Alabama couldn't meet that test, nor has North Carolina met that test, nor has most of the other covered jurisdictions met that test. So if there was an intent on the part of these states to run campaigns that didn't seek to disenfranchise African Americans and other racial minorities, they could have come into court and bailed out of those provisions, yet none could and none did.
What about that, Jeanette? The fact that they could have come out from under at any time and seem not to have met the test. Isn't that proof that this provision is still necessary?
But the framework, the preclearance framework, presumed that those jurisdictions, based on practices and voter turnout from the 60s, 1960s and 1970s, presumed that those covered jurisdictions were going to try to disenfranchise. And I think it's unfair to hold today's officials and today's America to, and not just America across the board, but these cherry-picked jurisdictions based on 40-year-old data. That's fundamentally the problem that the court had. And the majority recognized that Congress had compiled a lot of information and extensive record, but then didn't base its formula on that modern record, but elected specifically to rely on data from the 1960s and 70s to create the formula.
Let me ask you just to turn the question a little bit based on something you just said, Irving Joyner. Does that the fact that only those jurisdictions were under that provision, does that leave a lot of jurisdictions in this country off the hook and suggest that the rest of the country was clean when perhaps they deserved almost as much scrutiny?
Well, let's just say the covered jurisdictions weren't cherry-picked. They placed themselves there by their conduct. And conduct that not only was present in 1965, but has continued since that time. There are other jurisdictions that ought to be covered, that there's no doubt about that. But to say now that you ought to give these states a free rein to discriminate, as many states are now doing, against racial minorities in the voting process, and to eliminate their ability to register, to vote, and to participate in the franchise is simply unconstitutional and a ludicrous contention.
Go ahead, Jeanette.
I don't think it's fair to say that the jurisdictions which had been covered and are no longer covered have, in your words, free rein to disenfranchise. Again, Section 2's prohibitions still exists, the restrictions prohibiting standards or practices that would disenfranchise minorities, racial or language minorities, those still exist. They didn't disappear as a result of last week's decision, and we can't pretend that they have.
Yeah, but those are empty words until such time as you've been able to create a new record that you take to court and then spend another 8 to 9 years to go to the Supreme Court get those results thrown out. In the meantime, these illegal or unconstitutional governments are still going forward press their cases of discrimination.
Let's take a look at gay marriage and the Supreme Court, which struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, the provisions that say that, in fact, you can deny federal benefits to married couples of the same sex. Neil, tell us what happened.
Well, the case concerned U.S. against Windsor. It involved Edith Windsor, who married her long-term partner, Edith Thea Speier in Canada, and New York recognized their marriage as valid. And then when Ms. Speier passed away, Ms. Windsor was required to pay $363,053 in estate tax that she wouldn't have had to pay if she had been married to someone of the opposite sex. And she sued challenging Section 3 of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which defines the term marriage for all purposes under federal law, 1,138 purposes, to include only a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife. And the Supreme Court here, fracturing 5-4 in a majority opinion, written by Justice Kennedy and joined by Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Breyer and Kagan, held that this Section 3, this part of DOMA, was unconstitutional as a deprivation of the equal liberty of persons that is protected by the Fifth Amendment.
So, Jeanette, how do you read this? What's the significance of this decision, in your opinion?
I think I think time will tell. One of the things that I thought was probably most troubling about DOMA was that, and the court recognized this, it rejected the traditional notion that domestic relations are for the states. And I think it was a smart move on the part of the Supreme Court to recognize that DOMA disregarded that historic role of the states. I'm personally an ardent proponent of federalism, and so I think we need to make sure that the federal government stays out of those kind of domestic relations issues. And I think the court nodded its head in that direction.
Justice Scalia said that this opens the way for all states to challenge any prohibition on same-sex marriage. Irving Joyner, let me start with you. We'll go around the table. Does it do that?
Well, as I read the opinion, basically the court gave to states the right to make that decision as to whether you're dealing with traditional marriages or you're dealing with what we call the new style marriages. And I don't think that this opinion gives to the gay community the victory that they think that they have. It merely struck Congress's ability to come in with some law which is opposed to what the states have decided, which is a little different than opening the door for the states now to or to find that there is some discrimination in the prohibition on same-sex marriage.
Yeah, it seems to be what Justice Kennedy was trying to say. This is a very narrowly written decision, and it shouldn't open the way. Justice Scalia, on the other hand, says that by, quote, formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage as an enemy of human decency, and that word human decency was part of the majority opinion, or the phrase decency, Scalia goes on to say, the majority arms well every challenger to state law restricting marriage to traditional definition.
And I think Justice Scalia is right, right? So I have a very different reading of this opinion than both my friends. There is no doubt that Justice Kennedy emphasizes the traditional authority of the state to define what marriage is. But he says explicitly, this is not a federalism decision. I'm not basing this on federalism. Rather, I'm basing this on principles of equality and liberty. The federalism component is evidence of Congress's animus in enacting DOMA. Let me read from the majority opinion, and let your listeners
animus
decide.
Meaning mindset, what they were thinking, right?
Bad mindset, meaning a desire to impose a stigma, a desire to demean. This is what Justice Kennedy writes, and then ask whether this has implications for state bans on same-sex marriage. I agree that the court did not decide that issue in this case, but the logic and the rhetoric seem to me cut only in one direction. Justice Kennedy wrote for the court, DOMA undermines both the public and private significance of state-sanctioned same-sex marriages, for it tells these couples and all the world that their otherwise valid marriages are unworthy of federal recognition. This places same-sex couples in an unstable position of being in a second-tier marriage. It demeans the couple whose moral and sexual choices the Constitution protects and whose relationship the state is sought to dignify. And it humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples. There is language about states and state choices there, but that language about demeaning, about stigmatizing, about humiliating, language about what New York was trying to accomplish, which is to remedy inequality. It sought to eliminate inequality. DOMA writes inequality into the entire U.S. code. And so the court has not decided the question of same-sex marriage, but it seems to me going to be Justice Kennedy here is sending a signal about what is next on the horizon. And I think it's really just about what the other members of the majority, the members who didn't want the court to decide that question in the Prop 8 litigation, how far they're willing to go, how soon.
Well, it's interesting that and that we haven't talked about that yet, but the refusal to hear the Prop 8 decision from the lower court, mm-hmm. which essentially then leaves the law, allows gay marriage in right. California, yeah. right? Kennedy wanted to hear
That's right.
He wanted to hear that one. So, I mean, and, sort of what do we make of that?
And Justice Sotomayor wanted to hear that too. The court in that case held that there was no standing, that the state didn't want to appeal when they lost in the district court. The district court imposed a statewide injunction prohibiting Prop 8 from going into effect. Justice Kennedy, Justice Sotomayor, two of the five members of the Windsor majority wanted to hear that case. It's Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan who didn't want to go to the merits of the case. So I don't think the question now for proponents of gay marriage is how do you convince Justice Kennedy? I strongly suspect he's there. Mm-hmm. It's how do you convince those liberals on the court that there's not going to be a backlash if the court strikes down bans on same-sex marriage, that this is not going to be like Roe versus Wade all over again.
Yeah. And I agree. I agree with that. I think Justice Kennedy is inviting the challenges to come from the states. And I think, you know, you have a strong equal rights argument both on 14th Amendment ground and Fifth Amendment ground. But I think that the decision was much narrower than these strong pronouncements that he made in the case. And I think that the pronouncements are really where we want the court to go.
Although it's interesting, what do you make of the refusal to hear the Prop 8 case?
Oh, I think it's entirely consistent with the court's precedents on standing. And I would emphasize again that I think the decision is more narrow than a lot of proponents of same-sex marriage would like to have seen. I do think, as the other two guests have pointed out, Kennedy wants to see that litigation. I think his opinion foreshadows the kind of opinion he would write if the question were squarely before the court, but it's not. I think that's one of the things that made the Prop 8 case such a disappointment for advocates of same-sex marriage, because we really still have this big question. What are the constitutional rights of same-sex partners to marry?
Do you think then it opens up? I mean, let's come back to North Carolina and take a look at the constitutional amendment here banning gay marriage. Does this open the door, Neil? Let me start with you, to litigation that would challenge that constitutional amendment here in North Carolina.
I think it does. I think in both decisions, the court did absolutely nothing to hurt the cause of gay marriage and did a lot to advance it. The court did not decide that North Carolina's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. But this, to me, is the key question. What interest does North Carolina have in denying same-sex couples the ability to marry that the federal government didn't have in passing DOMA? If what the federal government did is about stigmatizing, demeaning, humiliating children, the court rejects moral opposition. The court rejects an interest in marriage and the relationship to procreation. right? The court rejects the idea that marriage is inherently involves opposite sex couples. It said that New York sought to eliminate inequality, right? Justice Alito in his dissent seemed to espouse that view that this, it's constitutive of marriage that it involves people of the opposite sex. So what interest does North Carolina have that's distinct from what the court thought the federal government was doing in DOMA? I don't know the answer to that question, and I haven't heard anyone who is prepared to defend these state bans on same-sex marriage articulate a distinct interest that wouldn't fall.
On the State of Things today, we're talking with Neil Siegel, a professor of law and political science at Duke University, Irving Joyner is a professor of law at North Carolina Central, and Jeanette Dorn, executive director and general counsel for the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Coming up in our next segment, we're going to talk about whether the politics has shifted and attitudes on gay marriage are changing. That and more on the State of Things. We'll take your calls at 877-962-9862 or emails at WUNC.org when our program continues. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about last week's Supreme Court decisions on the Defense of Marriage Act and the Voting Rights Act. With us are Jeanette Dorn, who is Executive Director and General Counsel for the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Irving Joyner is with us, Professor of Law at North Carolina Central University. Neil Siegel is a Professor of Law and Political Science at Duke University. And Mike Munger joins us now. He's a Professor of Political Science and Economics and Public Policy at Duke University. Mike, welcome.
Thanks.
I want to change gears here a little bit and talk about politics. In discussing the court decision on DOMA and the refusal to hear the Prop 8 challenge, does it suggest that the politics, that the political views on gay marriage are changing and they're not the lock that they were and the divisive issue maybe that gay rights and gay marriage used to be?
Well, of course, a year ago, May, we had a test here in North Carolina about what the views were on gay marriage, and 61%, at least of the people who voted, voted for adding a constitutional amendment. So I don't know that it would be changing in North Carolina. What I think is interesting is that this old federalism issue of states' rights is coming to the fore. And I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, Congress has spoken on the Voting Rights Amendment. We should let it go. Congress also spoke on the Defense of Marriage Act by almost the same majority. But we just decided in that case we didn't like what Congress said. So what the court does is looks at what Congress says and then makes some decisions about how to react to it. I think that the two things are quite different in the sense that the Defense of Marriage Act was an outcome. The Voting Rights Act was about a process. And so you can see that you have to be more solicitous of process. What I think is interesting is the central role that that states are going to take over the next 10 years when we try to deal with medical marijuana. These are things I really feel like it scrambled the political spectrum. A lot of people on the left now are advocating for states' rights. And this court in particular, Alito and Roberts, are much less 10th Amendment oriented. They're much more centrist and federalist in their perspective. The interesting thing that I think, let me just try to be provocative. I was pretty active in the debate over Amendment 1 in the time leading up to last May, and I actually thought that the Republicans had done something stupid because there would be a backlash against them. Looking at the numbers, looking at the turnout numbers, I would actually say that Amendment 1 is the reason that Romney won the state in November, because what it did was it gave the counties and the local Republican Party a way of organizing to combat the Obama turnout machine. Because Obama actually got 30,000 more votes in 2012 than he did in 2008, which is remarkable because there was much less enthusiasm for him. But there was another 150,000 for the Republican candidate, Romney. And so I actually think that political strategy was that may be the real reason that we were dealing with Amendment 1.
But the question is it losing traction? Because, you know, we saw that in the states that didn't go for Barack Obama in the second round that had in the first, North Carolina had the smallest margin, and that the margin of victory for Amendment 1 was the smallest for such an amendment in the South.
I'm actually claiming it was a cynical short-run tactic. Tom Tillis said, the Speaker of the House, actually said, you know, this will be gone in 10 years. I recognize that. It was a way of winning the 2012 election.
So it worked in 2012. Is it losing traction, Irving Joyner?
The polls suggest that there's been a reversal in the opinions of people about same-sex marriage, and that 54 or 55% of the people who were polled say that they supported same-sex marriages, and I think it's going to increase. It makes sense, but I think, you know, just from a constitutional perspective, the equal protection, both at the state level and at the federal level, argues persuasively that you can't discriminate against people based on who they choose to marry. It is a denial of equal protection and equal rights. And so I would hope that in North Carolina that notion is going to get challenged and challenged very soon.
Well, let me ask you, Neil, I'm going to turn the question slightly, but I'll give you a chance to answer the original, which is this question itself, is this issue, and if Mike is right that it's a cynical effort to just, you know, energize your base, maybe that's right or not. But is it losing traction? That's the main question. But what Irv Joyner is saying is, could that be part of it as well, that it is now turning on the question of rights and not on our question of, not on our sense of morality? Is this debate going on as long as it had, now focusing our attention on the rights issue rather than the kind of question of morality, whatever your church teaches?
Well, I think nationally, I'm much more familiar with the demographic data nationally. And what we're seeing is if you poll people under 30, more than 80% of the country believes in same-sex marriage. And if you poll people over 70, I would think it's less than a majority, maybe substantially less than a majority. So it's clear where the country is heading. I don't think the country is evenly distributed in terms of its sentiment, and I think the South is the place that's going to be most, in general, most hostile to a right to a same-sex marriage. North Carolina is an interesting state with a lot of people who didn't start out here, and they've settled here. And it went blue in 2008 and almost went blue in 2012. So I imagine as the country continues to move, and I think the Supreme Court's decisions are going to continue to have the country move, I imagine North Carolina is going to move. So that's what I would say about that. Amendment 1 passed by a very large margin. My guess is that if we do it again in 2014 or 2016, I'm not saying it wouldn't pass, but I don't think it would pass by quite as much a margin. But I really don't know the state-level data. In 10 years, I think it's going to be a very different situation. In terms of rights versus morality, that's a very interesting, deep, difficult question of jurisprudence about, can you think about rights entirely apart from morality, or is morality partially constitutive of the rights that we have? I don't think there's anything distinct about same-sex marriage in terms of how it implicates that issue. I do think the court is moving, is taking sides in this in this cultural disagreement, as Justice Scalia is charged. As I would add, he is taking sides. And I think as the court continues to have a conversation with the country, you're going to continue to see this debate move in the same direction. And I think it's going to make certain liberals on the court more comfortable over time as a matter of tact, judgment, timing, what I call statesmanship in my own work, to intervene if they're convinced that the Equal Protection Clause protects a right to same-sex marriage. As the country continues to move, I think they're going to feel more comfortable voting their considered constitutional convictions.
Jeanette, you think there's a political shift on this issue?
Yes and no. I think nationally there definitely is. I think in North Carolina that shift may be coming, but it may be coming more slowly, as evidenced by last year's Amendment 1. I'll be curious to see. I think it's only a matter of time before the amendment in North Carolina is challenged in court. And I'm curious to find out what Roy Cooper's position as Attorney General will be. Now, it's important to remember in Proposition 8, in that case, the governor and the attorney general of California refused to defend it. With Hollingsworth in the DOMA case, the attorney general would not defend it. So I wonder what Roy Cooper's strategy as our attorney general will be when and if our marriage amendment or Amendment 1 is challenged.
Let's go to the phones. We said we were taking calls, 877-962-9862. Paul Graham is on the line. Paul is on the line from Graham. You could be Paul Graham, but you're actually from Graham. Paul, hello. Welcome to the State of Things, Paul.
Hi. My partner and I, we're part of an interracial couple. We've been together over 13 years. Our relationship's outlasted three of my brother's marriages. One of the arguments here in North Carolina is the sanctity of marriage. And you know, a prostitute could marry someone from a foreign country, you name the country, and they wake up tomorrow and they have more rights and benefits than the two of us. And it just does not seem fair.
Well, thanks, Paul. We'll pass that around the panel, and I guess maybe I'll kind of rephrase that question about whether or not our sense of morality, and I'm talking now as voters, not necessarily as lawyers, is now trumped by a sense of equal rights when this debate, as this debate moves forward. But you can also respond directly to what Paul said. Mike?
A big problem in a democracy is that you have to balance two things, the will of the majority and the rights of individuals. And so the debate here is, are we going to allow the majority to define rights of individuals in this instance? And so it turns out to be a very difficult question. One of the things we have to rely on is forbearance. That is, people might have a view, but they're going to say, but it really shouldn't be my business. We've decided in this case that it is the state's business. And that's a very difficult thing to overcome.
Irving Jordan?
Yeah, well, the law gives to the state, the states, the right to make that determination. And I agree that this is that situation where, are there rights for the minority or the minority view that ought to be respected and protected by the law? I think that it should be protected by the law and not controlled by the majority. If you oppose to gay marriage, just don't marry anybody that's gay.
Well, let me stay with you for just a moment, because there had been a debate within progressive circles between gay rights advocates and black churches in particular and African-American constituencies about this question. This is a rights issue. We fought this battle. Didn't we fight it together? African-American church leaders in particular said, not this one. Is that changing?
Yes, some church leaders took that view, but there was a very active campaign led by the NAACP to help the African American churches and membership to understand the constitutional nature of the argument, which differed from the religious argument that's made. And Proposition 1 was not designed to direct what churches should do with respect to marriage, but rather what the government should do with respect to marriage. And I think that a lot of African Americans have better understood that view now and are more supportive and will become more supportive in the future.
Let's go back to voting rights, I guess. We'll talk about some of the what's going on in the state of North Carolina. We mentioned briefly voter ID, as Irving Joyner, you suggested that that is somehow a limit on voting rights. Advocates say, no, we're just trying to prevent corruption. This is an ID card. Everybody gets one. We're not saying anything about race in this case.
And our position that we've taken and articulated at the NAACP is that the North Carolina Constitution creates the qualification for voters. And once you move past those qualifications, you are exceeding what the Constitution demands. To that extent, requiring a voter ID is in excess of what the Constitution demands, notwithstanding, there's a legitimate argument that if you go to a store and use a credit card, but that's not a right. That's a business privilege that you have. What we're talking about here now are constitutional rights, and our forefathers created within the North Carolina Constitution those qualifications that they deemed to be necessary in order to qualify a person to vote. And once you go past that, then that becomes unconstitutional.
Neil Siegel, is the state exceeding its authority here? Doesn't the state get to write rules beyond what's in the Constitution governing elections? And haven't they changed in other states and other places?
I'll give you what I think is the correct answer and a useless one. It depends. I think this is an area in which it would be very nice to have more data and more evidence. So one side, Republican-dominated, is saying this is about the integrity of the election process and preventing voter fraud. The other side, the Democrats, are saying, no, it's not. It's about suppressing voter turnout among minorities and the elderly who are disproportionately likely to vote Democratic. And it would be nice to have some evidence. It would be nice to have data about, is there a problem of in-person voter fraud in North Carolina? How many cases have we ever had? Right? What is the evidence justifying this law? Who is most likely to be affected by this law? For people who have ID, it seems unimaginable that it would be difficult to get ID. But in fact, what those who are opposed to these laws say is that it's disproportionately minority voters and elderly voters. So if you know, I'd like to know more about the facts to see whether or not this is a reasonable regulation designed and will have the effect of securing the integrity of the electoral process, or is this partisan maneuvering, not that is inherently racist, right, or ageist, but because, you know, political parties want to win elections.
Well, there is evidence and there's data, and it's pretty easy to get because voter fraud would show up immediately because I would go to the polls, somebody had used my name, I would complain, and that's one. And so we can count those. They've been counted, and the incidents are small. In fact, they're much larger. There's more voter fraud with absentee ballots, which is not covered under the legislation.
Right. So what does that tell you about the purpose and effects of these laws?
Well, it suggests something, but it doesn't tell us anything. Jeanette, what does it tell you? Is this reasonable legislation given the low incidence of voter fraud?
Just because the legislation doesn't address every form of voter fraud doesn't mean that it's unconstitutional, because it leave some areas to be addressed down the road.
Well, Matt, I'm just going to just for one moment. Wouldn't it be prudent to address the largest form of fraud, which is absentee ballots? There's more of it, and there's evidence of that. What does that tell you?
I think that's a political question or policy decision, and I don't think it's up to the courts to make those kinds of political or policy decisions. It's what members of the General Assembly are elected to do. And going back to this question of adding qualifications, I don't think that voter ID adds qualifications. I think what it does is it asks the person showing up to vote to provide some verification, some proof that he is who he says he is. And in a way, it's not anything more than one step beyond what we have now, where when a person shows up to vote, they have to confirm to the poll worker that they are who they are. Well, now what we're doing is we're simply going to be asking the voter to produce some documentation in support of that attestation.
Mike Munger?
I worry about this, that on both sides, there's sort of a tempest in a teapot. There are a fair number of precincts in North Carolina where the number of registered voters exceeds the population. And the reason is we don't strip people who move away or die. Now, there's no evidence that those dead people or people who lived in other precincts have voted, but we wouldn't know if they didn't. So the absence of evidence is pretty tough. I don't know of any particular evidence that it would actually be that difficult to make a concerted effort to get people IDs or allow them to accept things that show their address. The number of things that would count as an ID are pretty large. Seems to me there's some demagoguery on both sides. What worries me is that each side is going to say that the integrity of the voting process is in question and voters are going to believe them. If we long enough, we each say the other side is a liar, voters are going to say you're right. They both are.
You all have spoken. It's the end of our program. Thank you so much for being with us today. Michael Munger is professor of political science, economics, and public policy at Duke. Neil Siegel, professor of law and political science at that same place. Irving Joyner, professor of law at North Carolina Central University. Jeanette Dorn is executive director and general counsel for the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.